Last week, we tried to establish 3 points. First point that we established was that there are 3 areas of living Jewishly. First is something that's an essential value, which is called Yirat Shamayim. One wants to stay in awe of heaven. 2 is something called Maaseh Mitzvot, doing the Mitzvot properly. We discussed that, expanded upon that. And 3 is Da'at Elohim, knowledge of God Himself. Whereas one would say that 1 and 2 are somewhat easy to come by, most yeshivot that go do in fact teach Shemirat HaMitzvot. They do in fact teach Yirat Shamayim through osmosis or otherwise. Da'at Elohim is something that is much more difficult. Knowledge of God is much more difficult. How does one teach? I get to see him. How does one teach Da'at Elohim? Maimonides, one of the greatest of Jewish minds, teaches us that Da'at Elohim, as we mentioned last week, point number 2, comes with the study of the natural order, physics, or known as Ma'aseh Bereshit. Rambam sees Ma'aseh Bereshit as physics, Ma'aseh Merkava, based on the 11th chapter, verse 11 of Yechezkel, as metaphysics. Metaphysics is that which subsists behind the physical universe. You have the physical universe, and you have those items, those spiritual substances, which are called God perhaps, which are in back of or above the physical universe. Rambam will tell us that this study gives us an insight into, as some have termed it, God's mind. The universe is a result of God's planning and God's mind, and therefore knowledge of the universe will give you an understanding of God's mind, not of God Himself, that all philosophers agree is impossible to come by. One cannot know the essence of Borei Olam. However, one can have an insight, as Einstein had said, others have said, into God's mind when one studies the physics of the universe. And of course, what's fascinating is that the physical laws of the universe, strangely enough, I think it's very strange, are the same laws which govern the subatomic universe, microcosmically, as well as the grandiose universe at large. Standing at those four, that those four laws of nature, strong and weak forces of the atom, the electromagnetism and gravity, those four forces govern the universe on its macro as well as on its micro level. This knowledge brings us, according to Harambai Maimonides, closer to loving and standing in awe of Borei Olam. Therefore, point number 3, a study of the universe, the physics, biology, chemistry of the universe, is religiously mandatory. One must study physics, chemistry, and biology, it's religiously mandatory, in order to have a love and stand in awe of God. So Rambam would stand with those other medieval rationalists, known as Rishonim, that one is obligated to study the universe, because you cannot love God without having an idea, a sense of who God is. And it can only know who God is by a study of the universe. Therefore, again, the study of science / philosophy is a religious obligation. Mitzvah to love God, stand in awe of God, Ahavat Hashem, Yirat Hashem. How do I fill this mitzvah? Not by simply stating it, not by simply mouthing it. You must have a conceptual understanding of this universe. You can't say, I love God. In the same way, you can't say, I love my wife, by just mouthing it. There has to be a corresponding concept or emotion which stands behind the verbalization of that statement, or that feeling, that idea, whatever it may be. There must, Harambam insists, in Morei Nevuchim, part 1, chapter 54, I believe, that there must be a concrete idea, a rayon, behind the verbalization. Verbalization means nothing if it does not have a conceptual attachment to it. So therefore, Harambam will tell us that one can only come to a real awareness of God with the study of the natural world, God's creation. This, in effect, of course, legitimizes the study of science religiously. And it legitimizes, it makes it mandatory. Sa'aj Gaon, Rabbeinu Bahya, Ibn Idra, Ramban would all agree with the above statements. Right? Now, again, I could bring you tons and tons of proofs from all those aforementioned thinkers to prove my point, but if one says Harambam, you're on safe ground. Now, let's take this one step further. If all this were true, 1,000 years ago, when Harambam wrote, 1135 to 1204, imagine how true it is today, that our scientific knowledge is on much more of a secure footing today than it was 1,000 years ago, right? Hopefully we'll all agree with that statement, unless you're a medieval person. Anybody here the medieval ages? Anybody? No? Okay, good. So you believe in that statement, and therefore our knowledge of God, of God's M.O., how He created the universe, Ma'aseh Bereshit, our knowledge of God's mind has vastly increased as well. So in that sense, we are much closer to an understanding of Borei Olam than Harambam was 1,000 years ago. Now, we may not take the next step, which is that knowledge should lead to love and awe of God. Harambam saw that as a very clear step. Other things happened, called the Enlightenment, in the last 500 years, which actually divorced religion from science. It was to the great detriment of mankind, one would say. But we'll modify that in a minute. But at least at the outset, one would say that our knowledge of the functioning of the universe is so much more profound, so much more true, so much more extensive, which gives us a greater level of Da'at Elohim than Harambam had 1,000 years ago. And therefore, we should come to the next point, which is love of God and standing in awe of God's creation. I am going to try in another few minutes to bring you not to the love of God. That I cannot do. That's an interesting question, why? But I may be able to bring you a sense of awe, as you'll see in a few moments. Therefore, when we study this topic, the closer we should be to Yirat Hashem, standing in awe of God. Science brings us closer to God, at least in the Maimonidean, Sa'adjian, Berechia, and all those great Jewish thinkers, they would say that. Now, one should be aware that science and religion are very strange bedfellows. As you know, it wasn't always so. Rather, yes, indeed, 1,000 years ago, science, philosophy, and religion dovetailed very closely. They divorced. Sadly, let's figure out who divorced who from whom. Who wrote the Get over here? The Get was probably written by science, wrote the Get. There was an attempt at reconciliation with Galileo, but here the spouse was so forceful, the church was so forceful in trying to bring them back together that they said to Galileo, my way or the highway. Thank you. That's so nice of you. Count on him. So the scientific world said, okay, then it's no deal. If you, the religious world, is going to say to us that the only way that we can remain married is my way or the highway, in the same way that it does not work in human relations, it didn't work between science and religion either, and therefore science took a separate pathway, and religion said, fine, we will take a separate pathway as well, to the detriment of religion. To the detriment of religion. Science, I will argue and tell you repeatedly, and you'll see in a few moments, is perhaps the greatest avenue to the confirmation of religion, if one understands religion properly. If one does not understand religion properly, then of course science can be devastating, a devastating attack, a nuclear attack on religion. It was so perceived going back 100 years ago. Let's say in 1851 when Wallace came out with his theory of evolution, made famous by Darwin 25 years later, that the church especially, not Judaism at all, we're much smarter than the church in many ways. We hedge our bets. So we have a lot of positions. Well, Kook would support evolution, as we'll come to down the road. And many other great Jewish thinkers supported evolution. Tver Israel, the great commentary on the Mishnah, he supported evolution 100 years ago, around the 1870s, 1880s. He said, yeah, evolution seems to be the correct way of viewing development of mankind. So we've always had our naysayers, for sure, but also we've had our supporters. Bless you. Right? So that way, we're on safe ground. Right? So that's one way of solving this issue. But 500 years ago, the Get was written by science, and only today, actually, there's a great deal of reconciliation between science and religion, to an extraordinary degree. Now, last week we began to read, Morris Tabish, you hear this? Not still? He's only first. I think he feels he's got his obligation by giving, okay. There are multiple sorts that you're going to find. Those who don't have these, take these. We can look at it very closely. It's a very nice article on science and religion. Whoever doesn't have it, please take. The new convergence. After centuries of battle, scientists and theologians are finally forging a grand unified theory. That's a pun, obviously. You know, of course, that the Holy Grail... Let's see it. You know, of course, that the Holy Grail of science is what?
Unification.
Unification. Einstein spent the last 20 years... We all know that Einstein spent the last 20 years of his life trying to unify these, mathematically, these four forces of nature. Right? Again, gravitation, electromagnetism, the strong and weak forces of the atom. Right? He tried to figure this all out, that those four should really equal one. Right? And I've often said before, there was an interesting insight about 30 years ago, that Einstein was, of course, a brilliant mind, and he strove so mightily for this unification, for this oneness of the universe. To him, it doesn't make sense for it to be so fragmented. What's fragmented? Four is called fragmentation. There must be one law of the universe, not four. And I made the point that, take note, that Einstein came to that point of, here, O Israel, the Lord of God, the Lord is one. Oneness is, from our point of view, Jewish point of view, the operating principle of the universe, oneness. Right? Einstein believes in that. He saw that. What did Einstein miss? The very next line. What's the very next line? Thereafter. Einstein could not come to a love of this principle of oneness. It's very hard to understand that. Because Einstein's God was empty of personality. It was empty of feeling. For Einstein, God was an abstraction. And therefore, though we tried to believe in the oneness, in the Shema, quote-unquote, so to speak, he believed in the Shema, in the oneness of the universe, he didn't and was not able to come to a Be'ahavta. Again, it's an interesting psychological question, why not? How does one come to a love of someone else? Is it taught? Is it natural? It's developed? It's an interesting question. Einstein could not see himself loving this. Okay, but nevertheless, after centuries...
He couldn't prove it? Is that why?
I'm sorry?
He was a practical man where everything had to be...
No, because he loved women. Certainly his mistresses he loved. So. No, so he understood, like he understood what love is all about, but it's the way he formulated the problem. In science, everything is formulation of the problem. How do you formulate it? So the way he formulated the problem, he ended up with a empty concept. In a sense, he was a deist, in a certain sense, that the founding fathers were. There is this God out there, I don't know what to do with it, but it's this concept of God that just didn't dovetail well with his physical world. So he had this oneness, but he didn't have the other. Yes, sir?
But he was not religious. He was Jewish, but not religious yet, and he did have problems with his wife.
That's correct. Okay, that's true.
So
that's true.
He didn't have the ability to love.
Perhaps. Like, okay, could be.
He could not
good point. Good point.
And he was not religious, but it never came from that angle. It was just
correct.
Mathematically
correct. It's a very good point. You wonder, if this is so clear, why didn't Einstein not get it?
Right.
One of the things that I had done when I was younger was, and I mentioned this before also, a couple of years ago, is figuring out why the great minds of the 20th century did not believe in God. One I thought was Sartre, so I read his autobiography called The Words. Two was Bertrand Russell, read his autobiography. Great minds. To me, great minds should equal religion. You know, that's what, in my naivete, when I was in college and post, I believe it should work that way. So, are there other factors that do play into a person's psychology which does not bring you that equation? Which is, again, great minds should equal religion, from my point of view. But why from my point of view? That's a Rollins' point of view. My minds would say, great minds should equal religious. It doesn't. Why not?
I think that academia sometimes has a fear of accepting religion. And then sometimes people that when they're around academia, they just take on that same
persona. Okay, good point. It's their problem, therefore, is that it's their understanding of what religion is all about. It's the same point that you're making. One of the great minds of the 19th century was a friend of mine, Friedrich Nietzsche. Most of you don't know who he is. But he's an extraordinary personality, a great mind, a person I really had a great emotional attachment to when I read his works, going back again in my youth. And Nietzsche, of course, was an enemy of religion. He believed in the Antichrist, and of course he was misquoted and taken out of context as support for the Nazis. Right? But he believed in people overcoming their human side to be more than human. The Übermensch in German, the Übermensch. And I couldn't figure out what went wrong with this guy. So till Dr. Greenberg had the insight that Nietzsche's whole understanding of religion was Christianity, which tried to emasculate the human being. So Nietzsche, who believed in the power of the human being to overcome his finitude, was of course anti-Christian. Had Nietzsche known Judaism, which of course he didn't, and we of course empower human beings, we want you to reach for the stars and go beyond the human as well. Who is to say that who we are right now is the limit that God has placed upon us? There are no limits that God has placed upon us, one would argue. And Rabbi Soloveitchik, of course, argues that point in The Lonely Man of Faith, the first chapter. Lonely Man of Faith is a book about the advancement of human knowledge. The only issue is that for 6 days of the week, you are to advance human knowledge. And yet, on the seventh day, what is a cardinal sin, therefore, is thinking that you become God. That's called paganism. If Torah allowed you to advance human knowledge to the point where you became convinced, and this has been the great sin of mankind throughout the last 2,000, 3,000 years or 4,000 years, where you deify yourself because of your power, because of your knowledge. Knowledge is power. You deify yourself because of that, then you've denied God. But as long as you're aware that you are you, limited human being, a little less than divine, we say, but you're always a little less than divine. That's Pasuk Tehillim. Notice how 3,000 years ago David said, what's the human all about? He is a little less than divine. Judaism is an empowering religion for the human being, as long as the human being understands and knows, ultimately he is not God. That's the critical variable. And Shabbat tells you to do what? Shabbat tells you, take a step back from your creativity, from your energy, from your conquering, and celebrate your awareness of God. That's what Shabbat is all about. Glorifying God on Shabbat is the essence of Shabbat. The other 6 days of work, 6 days of the week, you shall create and grow and conquer and explore the heavens. So had Nietzsche known Judaism, he may not have written all about his anti-Christianity. He was the father of the God is Dead movement, going back 120 years ago. In any case, back to this. So now, science and religion are bedfellows, and they're coming together again as they were 1,000 years ago, although the terms are different. When a husband and wife reconcile, after a period of estrangement, this was a 500-year estrangement, there are different terms, but it's really working out extraordinarily well. There's only one article that's from a scientific magazine. We're going to see... Also, as we go, if we have the time, we may not have the time. What is the other? Here, from the Skeptical Inquirer, a very famous magazine. The magazine for science and reason, right? And they're, of course, the fathers of debunking religion. What's religion? It's superstition. They're concept religion. Here, science and religion, conflict or conciliation. They're the greatest scientific and religious thinkers who are now going to debate the issue. And we're going to talk about that as we go along. You notice over here, one half is Einstein, and one half is Yeshua.
Is that a cover magazine?
I would not have wanted to put Yeshua here. I don't think that's a bad cover. Put Moshe Rabbein or something. But, yeah, you're right. This is huge. Good point, yeah. Yeah, this is current. This is about 6 months old, 5 months old. Sorry? You want. You got it, you too.
When did you subscribe?
I renew it again depending on who I read. When it's bad, I just say I want to do it. So we get it. Okay, so we're going to come back to that and see how some of the world's greatest minds, physicists and chemists and biologists, are going to be pro-religion and some of them are not. We'll get to that as we go along. So now this article is a great article. Again, I'm not going to read the whole thing to you, but I just want to give you some sense of what this is all about. The ancient quote from 1970, which is relatively recently, the ancient continents and pieces, man knows at least that he is alone in the universe, unfeeling immensity out of which he emerged only by chance. key issue. What Judaism says about religion is that, about science, is that we would never agree that it's by chance. So pronounced the Nobel Prize winning anthropologist Jacques Monod in his 97th year, Sense of Necessity, said that God has only been utterly refuted by science. The divine is fiction. Fate is hokum. Existence is a matter of causeless probability. This wasn't just speculation, but proven. Astounding statement to make. This essay, which had tremendous influence on the intellectual world, seemed to conclude a millennium-old debate. Theology was in retreat, unable to explain away Darwin's observations. Intellectual approval was flowing to the thinkers such as Nobel Laureate President Steven Weinberg, we discussed last week, who said, pronounced, quote, the more the universe seems comprehensible, the more it all seems pointless. Right now, if you were living around the 1970s or 1980s, you would have been devastated by these attacks on religion. In 1981, the National Academy of Sciences declared religion and science are separate and mutually exclusive realms of human thought. Case closed. And now reopened. In recent years, Alan Saninger, one of the world's leading astronomers, has declared that the Big Bang can be understood only as a miracle. Quote unquote. Miracle is a term of religion. Charles Tan, a Nobel-prizing physicist and co-inventor of the laser, has said that discoveries of physics seem, quote, to reflect intelligence at work in natural law. That points to a God. Biologist Christian Dirac, also Nobel Prize winner, points out that science argues neither for nor against the existence of a deity. So that's an interesting perspective. There's no sense in which atheism is enforced by or established by science. Good. Now we go on. Ever so gingerly, science has been backing away from its case-closed attitude to the transcendent unknown, which is my point right now. Conferences that bring together theologians, physicists are hot, taking place at Harvard, Smithsonian, big other universities, etc., including E.O. Wilson, the late Stephen Jay Gould, Carl Sagan, have endorsed some form of reconciliation between science and religion. These are the greatest minds in America. Jay Gould, Carl Sagan, E.O. Wilson, all of them, science and religion. Why the renewed scientific interest in the spiritual thinking? What is the cyclical nature of intellectual fashions? Okay, philosophy, metaphysics, make a comeback. These restrained, empirically based ideas have run their course. Now the pendulum is swinging toward the grand vision of metaphysics. Some days, surely it's swing the other way. Similarly, in science, the pure materialistic view that remained 20th century, natural explanation couldn't keep other viewpoints at bay. Quote, they emphasized the age-old notion that there is more to existence than meets the eye, suddenly looks like fresh thinking again. Good. As recent as the 70s, intellectuals assumed that hard science was on track to resolve the two really big questions, why life exists and how the universe began. What's more, both really big answers were assumed to involve strictly deterministic forces. But things haven't worked out that way. Instead, the more scientists have learned, the more mysterious the really big questions have become. So that's interesting. The more we know that we don't know. That's his point. Good. Finally, he goes, look at the next column. Look up at the night sky and scan for the edge of the cosmos. You won't find it. Nobody has yet instruments such as the Hubble Space Telescope field scans of at least 50 billion galaxies. We'll come back to the galaxies in a moment. Every time equipment has improved, more galaxies further away have come into focus. Space may be infinite, not merely vast, but infinite, endless, encompassing an infinite number of galaxies, an infinite number of stars. All this stuff, enough to form 50 billion galaxies, maybe fantastically more, is thought to have emerged 40 million years ago in less than a second, from a point with no physical dimension. That's impossible to believe if you are a rational person. To think that all of the people in this room, and the books, and the shelves, and the table, and the fruit, at one point was all encompassed in one dimensionless point is impossible to believe, right? That's crazy to believe. Now imagine that this whole entire building, and that was the whole block, and even the whole of Brooklyn, and the whole Earth, and the whole Milky Way galaxy, which we'll come back to, and all the whole Milky Way galaxy, and every single 50 billion galaxies, and put it all into one little tiny dot that you can't see, and say it's all together. If I told you anything, I was crazy. You wouldn't believe me. You'd lock me up and put me away. And I would stay away. Because this is an absurd idea. That's what science is saying today. All of the universe, with its 50 billion galaxies, with its 100 million billion stars, was all at one point in time one little tiny mote, less than a speck, all tightly packed together. You believe that? I think it'd be foolish if you do, but that's the truth. Sometimes truth is foolishness. So that's what they're saying over here. 50 billion galaxies are all little tiny packed together. With the point, there's no physical dimensions. Set aside the many complete explanations are of the Big Bang. Something made the entire something we call it by one name, you call it by another name. He calls it something. Made an entire cosmos out of nothing. It is realization that something transcendent started it, which has hard science types such as standards using terms like miracle. Okay? Skip down. That if there had been a Big Bang, the galaxy would be rushing away. Now, also, besides all this stuff, that if there had been a Big Bang, the galaxy would be rushing away from one another. This too idea was ridiculed. That came along with Lemaître, 1977, Catholic physicist, who said, I can't live with these two worlds. So what do I have to do? I have to bring these two worlds together. And he came up with this hypothesis, which was ridiculed from 27 to 67, that it all started out with an atom. In 27, with the designation of a primordial atom of infinite density, the idea was ridiculed as a transparent ploy to bring Genesis on technical grounding. Lemaître closed a testable prediction that if there had been a Big Bang, the galaxies would be rushing away from one another. This idea too was ridiculed until Edward Hubble stunned the scientific world in 29 by presenting evidence of cosmic expansion. It's astounding. And they laughed at Hubble too for 25, 30 years. How did he prove it? How did he find that out about? It's called the redshift. It means that if you see light, light is made up of many types of energy. And by virtue of, his name is German scientist, Fraunhofer lines, where you could see light broken up into its different forms of energy. It has different colors.
Yeah.
So you go for different colors. So if it comes from red to this to red shift, that means it's getting further away from us. Mm-hmm. Similar to the Doppler effect, which was discovered in the 1870s, 1880s. So he saw that, and he discovered that by virtue of his telescope, he sees light broken up into its different energies, and he says, this is crazy. The galaxies are getting further away from us. And the further they are, the faster they're going. So yesterday they were closer. And where were they 2 weeks ago? Closer. And a month ago? Closer. And where were they at the beginning of time? Smack right on top of us. Mm-hmm. Right? So he proved the point. That's that was Lemaître and that was Hubble. Right? Now, in 47, Hoyle, one of the greatest of the world, says, impossible. That's crazy. What's the universe all about? It is a static system. Not dynamic and expanding, implying creation, Bereshit, but a static system.
This is Einstein believed that too.
Yes.
Static.
Yes. Yes, up to a certain point. Correct. Till 65. And in 47, he laughed at those and he coined the phrase Big Bang. Absolutely impossible. You believe in a Big Bang, you're a fool. Until 1965, Arnold Penzias lives in New Jersey. Not in Brooklyn, New Jersey.
Belmont?
Not Belmont, North Jersey. But close by. And a guy named Wilson discovered what's known as cosmic background radiation. Couldn't figure it out until they came to the conclusion, 65, another sort of Big Bang echo, the cosmic background radiation discovered, soon it was assumed, because it would be able to say, if everything happened, step one, step two, step three. The cosmologists do think that they know a fair amount about steps 2 and 3, what the incipient cosmos was like, the instant after the genesis, how matter and energy later separated and formed the first galaxies. I'll come back to that, you'll see more clearly. Nobody knows beyond foggy conjecture what caused the Big Bang. What is our answer to the cause of the Big Bang?
God.
Borei Olam, God. Correct. What, if anything, was present before the event? Stephen Hawking will tell you in his Scriptures of the Universe, in his videos, if we have time we could show you, will say that I can explain the physics of the universe up to the first trillionth of a second of the Big Bang. Before that, only God knows. Quote, unquote. Right? So that's from an atheist. Check it out. Splashes of how the mass of an entire universe could pop out of a void are especially unsatisfying. Experiments as of July by the Brookhaven Mission Lab in New York measured probably stuff without particles known as muons, finding what they how they behave as though influenced by other particles, seem to materialize from nothingness. We go on and on and on and on.
So because they can't explain it, that's how they attribute to Hashem?
No, nobody knows. Nobody knows. Some do, some don't. Some will say, like Stephen, like Weinberg, no, we just don't know yet enough about it. Eventually we'll know everything. But I will challenge that if we do know everything, does that deny God? No. So this may be the mechanism by which God decided to create the universe.
Right, so the difference between what Rambam understood on science and what we understand on science, it doesn't matter.
What do you mean?
The fact is, we don't really know any more than he knew to the fact
that... No, we know a lot more than he knew.
We know that there's a lot more, but we don't have...
The ultimate question,
answer.
The ultimate question and answer we don't have. That's correct. At this point. Right, but we'll see. Okay, good. Next page, I can't stand that. At that time, cosmologists tended to assert that the cause of progress were unknowable, the bizarre things of singularity. That point is called singularity. That point, 12 billion years ago, singularity. The preceded explosion, they explained, presented an information wall that blocked all knowledge of the prior condition of physical laws. We will never know. The more scientists testily insisted that the Big Bang was unfathomable, the more they sounded like medieval priests saying, "Don't ask me what made God." Alan Guth, unknown physical laws. This is the 50 billion galaxies isn't the only mystery of that's prompting scientists to rethink their attitude to the divine. Beyond this is the puzzle of why humans are susceptible to living creatures. This is called the anthropic principle, right? Which everything works out so well. We're going to explain how amazing it is that that human life exists on this planet. It's virtually impossible. It's 1 in 10 to the 25th power that this could happen accidentally. Right? That's in which book is that? It's in one of these books here. Yeah, Science of God and his Science of Big Bang and Creation. All that. So it's there as well. He figured out it. Now, in recent years, we've sort of calculated that if a value called omega, the ratio between the average density of the universe and a density that would hold cosmic expansion, had not been within about 1/4 of 1%. Say that again?
We believe you.
Not me, him. If it had not been within 1/4 of 1% of its actual value immediately after the Big Bang, the incipient universe would have collapsed back on itself or experienced runaway relativity effects that would render the fabric of time-space really distorted.
It
means that it had to exist, it had to work within 1/4 of 1%. Otherwise, what would have happened? The force of the universe expanded. Either would have, because of gravity, would have gone back to the. Because the universe had to expand. You have energy expanding, gravity pushing it back. Right? So it's the perfect balance.
It explains.
Had it been 1/4. It does?
Sentence.
Next sentence. What did you ask that question for? Do your homework. Would have collapsed back on itself because the gravity would have pulled it back in, right? Or experienced runaway relative effects that would render the fabric of time space with the. Instead, the firmament is geometrically smooth. In the argument, if gravity were only slightly stronger, research shows stars would flame so fiercely they would burn out in a single year. Therefore, what would happen if the star called the sun burned out in a single year? What would happen? You'd have no Earth. So it's perfect. The universe would be a kingdom of cinders, devoid of life. If gravity were only slightly weaker, 1/4 of 1%, the stars couldn't form at all. And the cosmos would be a thin, undifferentiated blur. Had the strong force which binds atomic nuclei been slightly weaker, all atoms would disperse into vapor. These, quote, cosmic coincidences were necessary to create a universe capable of sustaining life. Without all this craziness, you would not have had life. This is crazy numbers. This book documents, David, nice book? You like this book, David? You did. This book, sorry? Well, we all are. those of us who are intelligent are. This book goes into many, many more of these kinds of crazy numbers. Your things are still here. Those are your things. They're still here. You want to get David liked on page 189? That's David. I write not exactly. He loves it, though.
Not
exactly. That's what I wrote. Not exactly. But you liked it. I wrote silly. You said you liked it. You liked it. That's right. This book is a brilliant book. Why is it a brilliant book? Because it does all of this mind-boggling kind of information to extraordinary degrees. George Greenstein. Right? George Greenstein. Who, again, he's a PhD from Yale, Stanford. He's not an atheist. He doesn't know what to believe in. He can't believe in God.
I don't believe in God.
He can't believe in our traditional notion of God. He will end up saying that the universe itself is God. Something to that effect. He's raised without any Jewish education, so his understanding of God is a very immature, primitive understanding of God. One can have, obviously, a profound understanding of God. One can have an immature understanding of God. That's all obvious, right? Each of us here has, those who think about it, has a different understanding of what God really is. If you're influenced by Spinoza, then you're a pantheist. All is God, which means me too. So that's a pretty scary thing to think about. If you're, let's say, a deist, then you believe God created, like Newton, then you God created the universe and left and abandoned it. So it depends what your view of God actually is. And of course, Jewishly, we have no full understanding about God because we can't understand the essence of God. And therefore, we have no name for God because name is definition. When Moshe asks Hashem, Shemot Pedagimel, Yamuli Mashem, what's your name? How do we define you? And God is what? Beyond time. I'm beyond time. God's beyond time, beyond space. Which is why what I said to you last year is true. Most people have a pagan belief in God. Most of us here who haven't thought about God or really have a pagan understanding, which means we localize God in time and space. God, help me. If you think God is up there, you're a pagan. God is not up there. God is not down here. God is not right. God is up. Why not? Because God's not part of space. It's two different categories. It's apples and oranges. Bananas and cherries, you like? Okay. Either way. So, the symbiotic universe, life and mind, the cosmos, he pinpoints and says to you how impossible it is for man to exist without something pushing it in that direction, but I can't believe in God. I can't believe in really saying in the traditional understanding of what God is.
Why not?
Because he did not grow up with a profound understanding of God. To him, God is somebody out there that has little strings and pulls people along and does everything in that fashion. His understanding of God is what I'd call an immature, primitive view of God. One can be brilliant in one area and naive and immature in another area. As is obvious, right? Brilliance does not necessarily mean you're brilliant in everything. You can be brilliant in some things and immature and naive in other things. Yes? Why?
I know somebody.
Not
dead. I just wanted to make the point that the direction of what you're saying is impressing me the opposite way, in the sense that science has the ability to say, we really don't know, and we can't figure it out, and it's very, very complicated, and truly something is out there that caused this whole wonderful universe to happen.
Some yes, some say no.
Some say no, we don't find out, or we won't find out, or something like that. But
right.
It's like Galileo said, I looked at the stars, I did this, I did that, I figured out it's not possible that the sun revolves around the earth. It must be that the earth revolves around the sun. And therefore, I have to change my whole world
view
in order to accept that. And I think that that's the process of science. Things that seem impossible turn out to be verified in some way. And religion, in a lot of aspects, says we know all the answers already.
No, only in your view of religion.
Not my, the message that I get.
That you got. That's not my view of religion at all.
But if I told you maybe the world is 5,774 years old, instead of 5,764 years old, many, many authorities would say,
Many of thought, many of thought.
Many authorities wouldn't be in the class like this either.
You have to be careful with those statements. You want to, you don't want to make hasty generalizations about the many authorities. That's true. Religion has many authorities. So, but that's irrelevant to me. Because I could show you that if there's one great authority, like Harambam, Maimonides, who will say the opposite of that. That religion is a process of knowing more and more and growing about certain areas. On the other hand, we as religionists would accept, of course, what I just said as a premise, but would not accept the notion that we don't know anything about morality and ethics. We're going to make absolute assertions that one should not kill, one should not steal, one should not commit adultery. We are going to make absolute assertions about certain areas of life. Ultimately, Judaism is much more concerned about morality, ethics, and the development of the human being than it is about scientific questions. Because ultimately, we're not going to get to that ultimate end of the scientific universe. We're not going to know God at the end. Ethics is something that we do make absolute assertions about.
Okay, and I'm sure science will certainly grant that to religion or to philosophy.
Some do, some don't.
Science really doesn't have an ethical basis,
right,
except whether to use an atomic bomb or something like that.
And I didn't think, yeah, correct, right.
That kind of
thing. Right. So it is true to some degree, what you're saying, but one needs a lot of footnotes and a lot of caveats and a lot of qualifying statements, is what I would say.
Okay. And then let me just ask you one other question about Genesis in Bereshit, where...
We're going to get to it. We're going to get to it yet. But again...
God says, in case...
You think God really said something?
The Bible says that the Word of God, or that maybe man will be like us, or, you know,
right. Let us be like... Okay.
No, he had to punish man.
Chapter 3.
Right, okay. Thrown out of the Garden of Eden.
Right.
Now that they ate from the tree of knowledge, they could be like us, so they have to be immortal.
Yeah, do you think that really is to be understood literally?
That's a story.
Do you think it should be understood literally?
No, I don't take it literally. I take it as...
Do you think any great Jewish authorities understood it metaphorically?
Yes, but I think the communication today... Again, I don't want to generalize and say everybody does that, but there is a method of learning that says, yes, this is literally...
That's irrelevant, that there is a method of learning. I say that method of learning is more Christian than it is Jewish.
That's becoming more predominant.
That's a political question. It's not what we're interested in over here. I mean, you're right, true, but that's not what I'm worried about. You know, I'm saying, in other words, I don't need to buy that. That's...
Okay, that's good to hear.
If there's nothing else tonight, Chucky feels like good about it. I feel good. Okay. Let me just quickly finish one more point about this article, which is, again, the same. The weather in probable conditions. Again, you want to know more about the improbable conditions? It's something called the Anthropomorphic Principle. If this book gives a great explanation of it, we'll come back to it. Came to be known as Epiphany to the physicist Charles Townes, and the universe resolves an attention that has been in the quantum theory. Underlying, they don't like quantum theory because it leaves you looking for spiritual explanation because of that they didn't. Religious scientists are going to be drawn together for a long time trying to figure out the philosophical implications of why the universe turned out favorable to us. The universe works. That's the amazing point about it. With each bang, when supposed physical laws and constants are determined anew by random forces, that's a way of discussing it. And let's just... leave this for here, for now. Let me give you one example, which I did Xerox for you, of this improbabilities. I made 20 copies, so you have to share. Why do I keep doing that? That's improbable, let's do it right, right? Given that, I made 20 copies.
Underestimate yourself.
Now, try to give them, and I'll read it slow. Sorry? Yes, I know. Jack Dweck also read the book. He borrowed it. Now, this is... Yeah. We want to talk about balance. Listen, please, very closely. I'm sorry to make enough copies, but if I'll read it slowly. To show you how impossible it is for the universe to exist. Yeah, this is a PhD from Yale, Stanford, Princeton, YU. Thank you. They use all those places. Is that why you was up, which is interesting. He tells us, we all know that an atom has a positive and a negative charge to it. Electron is negative. If the electron carried more charge than the proton, proton is positive, electron is negative, right? Then these two, then any two items would not be in perfect balance. Right now they're in perfect balance, right? What would happen if the electron carried, let's say, 20% of a more powerful charge to it? What would happen? Good. Objects would still contain equal numbers of each particle. It's called atomic weight. But the charges would no longer add up to zero. Right? Rather, it would add up to a net minus. Every object in the universe would be charged negatively, and like charges would repel one another. The table in the corner would repel the lamp, the tree outside the window, the car beneath the tree would be flung apart. My left hand, my right hand would possess a net negative charge as they were shoved apart. My arms would extend outward. My feet would repel my head, my blood, my bowels. In general, my entire body would be forced to expand because they're repelling each other. Right? As with the lamp, the table, the tree, and the car, a universal repulsion would result. Now, how powerful would be the force of repulsion? Its strength would depend on the degree to which the charge of the electron and proton differed. Small differences, small repulsion. On the other hand, so powerful are electrical forces in general, and so enormous are the objects of subatomic particles, even the smallest of objects. How many how many atoms are in this cup? About 100 billion? 100 billion, let's say? Imagine how many atoms there are in this room, right? Now, on the other hand, so powerful, and so enormous are the numbers of stuff, thank you, that even very small differences would lead to very great forces. A mere 1% offset between the charge of the electron and that of the proton would lead to catastrophic repulsion. 1% off. If the electron was 1% more negative than the proton, my arms would not just extend outward, they would rip from my body, blast away from the earth, and actually fly up into outer space. As they rose upward, followed by my teeth, my hair, they would themselves distend and burst. My entire body would dissolve in a massive explosion if it's 1% off, because there's so many atoms in our body. So too the ocean, which would rise from its bed in a rush, flashing into stream, cold steam. The mountains would rip from the fabric of the continents to hurl up or dissolve into pebbles, and the pebbles would dust. The very earth itself, the planet as a whole, would crack open and fly apart in an annihilating explosion. The same would happen to every other planet, after the moon, after all moons, after the sun and stars, and these every material body in the universe. This is what would happen were the electrons charged to exceed the protons by 1%. The opposite case, in which the proton's charge to the electrons will lead to the same situation, because it's going to be repulsion. For all things would then be charged positively, like charge repel one another, no matter what their sign. Good. No, he says. 1% is too great a discrepancy. How precise must the balance be? How accurately must the charge of the electrons be matched with that of the proton before the disaster could be avoided? The question is easy to answer. A good high school student could do it. Anybody here graduate high school? So do it. What does it say? Relatively small things like stone, people, and the like would fly apart if the two charges differed by as little as 1 part in 100 billion. Small things like us would fly apart if the charges differed by 1 part in 100 billion. Because those are small, they still have, millions of atoms. So each one's going to repel, so 1 part in 100. Larger structures, like the Earth and the Sun, require for their existence yet more perfect balance. 1 part in 1 billion billion. That's 1/1 billion billion. That's how many zeros?
E. That's E on the calculator.
I don't need those calculators. Can't deal with that. 1 billion billion. It's that perfect. If that electron was 1 billion billion of more negative charge, 1 billion billion, then everything does, nothing works. Everything in nature has just the things to do better than that accuracy. Right? If the Yankees knew this, they would have won the World Series. They didn't get it. Physicists would not be here to learn the fact, nor anyone else. Once again, lacking such extraordinary precise adjustment and of its microscopic properties, the cosmos would have been uninhabitable, unhabitable throughout all space and all time. It would have been unknowable, invisible. Once again, the strong anthropic principle explains, quote unquote, all. Once again, the special office only fails to provide an accounting. Because often we don't know why it exists so perfectly, and yet it does. I don't know that it does, because I'm here.
That sounds like a huge assumption.
What?
Did he ever do it?
It's all mathematical. Of course he did it. Of course he did it. He did it on a microscopic level. And what's true in science, what's true for the small, because the same laws of science apply.
So he was able to do it on
a microscopic level. Of course you can do it, yeah. And everybody, if you just do any scientific experiment on a microscope and you magnify it, the same laws exist microscopically and they do macroly, on the macro scale. And that's only one example of that. One second. One second. So, this book again has hundreds of these kinds of examples where everything seems to work extraordinarily well. Yeah?
I'm just trying to put this in context.
Forget that. We lost context a long time ago. But okay, yeah, try.
Very unprobable things are... You're saying, prove that God can...
I'm not saying. I didn't say that at all. I didn't say God. I didn't use... You may want to say that. I'm not saying that. Yes.
These authors.
They're not saying God. He doesn't believe in God. Where is he? He doesn't believe in God.
He's saying something other than something very highly...
Intelligent?
Intelligent. He thinks that created a balance of which, without something very highly intelligent...
And that's only one factor of another thousand examples that we could give each other that it worked.
What's to say that... The imbalance didn't get tried many, many times.
Nothing.
Well, the balance came out.
Nothing. But there's a thousand of those other factors that had to coordinate perfectly well to end up with this universe.
But it did.
It did. Right, so everything ended up working well.
Unlikely.
I'm sorry?
It's not probable, but it's possible.
Yeah.
It did.
Yeah, you want to bet on that? You can bet on that.
It'd be a good bet if it happened.
Right. I can't lose. No, I agree. In other words, what you're arguing now is that there might have been a billion...
Chances are nobody in this room is going to win the lottery tomorrow.
What a pessimist.
But someone's going to win. You got to play it.
Play when, thank you.
Someone's going to win.
Yeah, okay.
Nothing's to say that... Before all this,
we agree. I'm not trying to prove God here tonight. Let me just make this point. What you're really saying is that let's assume that this universe worked perfectly well. It did, obviously. Prior to it, guess what there was? There was another universe which didn't work perfectly well.
Maybe hundreds.
And there was
billions and billions. And billions.
How many customers do you want to sell this year? Billions and billions and billions.
E.
E. So, yes, you're right. And none of them actually work. That's right. Exactly right. So, that is certainly possible. That's the question of where that's the question of how far you want to go with this same quotient. Yes, one can find and say that there were a billion attempts at this.
In an infinite amount of time, also.
And an infinite amount of time. Right. So in which case, you would end up saying, everything is meaningless, and I'm going to walk home depressed tonight. Because what it means, that's one possibility.
No, she's saying that the possibility of it happening is not that improbable, because we're here. In other words, it's just like you said, in other words, the guy who wins the lottery says, I can't believe I won the lottery. Why not? Someone's going to win. In other words,
but the probability
is
still
thing.
I don't play a lotto, but the fact that someone's got to win.
What is that?
Given all the random possibilities.
We agree.
Maybe it's not that far. It's not as far.
It's still one. It's still.
It's not infinite. Maybe it's not each. It's hundreds of times.
Okay, it could be. We have the famous midrash that says, "Baral was Mahariban." The famous midrash assumes that you're saying and says that yes, there were many, many universes before, and that could be the answer. This universe worked out perfectly well with all these things, but it was taking a billion, billion, billion chances before that. Which, yes, might have been. If you want to believe that, one can believe that. Let me go a little bit further, okay? Sorry, yeah.
Not the belief of the author of the book, because it seems a little strange.
What is that? What is that?
That there were billions of opportunities.
No, he doesn't know. No, he doesn't know.
You're hearing one example from a book that you're saying is filled with all of this.
Yes, yes.
And he can't come to the conclusion of a God in control of this?
No.
So what's the conclusion he comes to?
The universe itself decided, I want mankind. The universe, symbiotic means where the universe wanted it to happen. The universe itself wanted to produce life, in his understanding of it.
Through trial and error.
No, just no, not the trial. It just produced it. Produced it. Yeah, David.
Someone over there, I don't know his name. He said he wants to put this in context.
Yeah.
And then the context that we got, and then this gentleman over here asked the question. The context we got is that there were universes before this one where the balance was off. But I think what science says today is that there is matter, antimatter, annihilation all the time. So it's not that there were universes before. There are particles that exist that are not in balance and annihilate themselves all the time. It's just that the particles that do exist are in perfect balance.
Yeah.
So that is the context. Not the context of the context, but there may have been other universes before that never made it.
Both could be. Who knows? No. We don't know. Only God knows.
But in this universe,
as well, true,
there are particles that are not in balance, and they annihilate.
Right. Yeah.
Annihilation going on.
Yeah, somewhat. So. Yeah. I mean, that's part of the perfect balance. Part of the balance.
But that's the context.
Right.
That is the context.
Yeah, it's one of the contexts.
I mean, no. My problem with this statement that you read is a great example, but it's really out of context. It's saying that this is a static position, that the balance was static. It is not. In the time of the Big Bang, there were these imbalances. So it's almost, you could almost make an argument for a self-tuning universe.
Yeah, the problem again with that is that that statement is out of context. As well. Because I said that before. There's a lot of other statements as well which present the whole picture.
You mean Greenstein's?
Yeah. Let me go on a little bit more. In order to us to raise the right questions about Bereshit, we have to just get a little bit more of a sense as to what we're talking about. So now, we're talking about over here, as far as we know, 50 billion galaxies in this universe and growing. Galaxies such as the Milky Way, our galaxy, is 100,000 light years large. Right? 100,000 light years. What does that really mean? 100,000 light years large means that you take some item traveling at the speed of light, which is 180,000 miles per second, and then some, right? Take that and let it travel for 60 seconds equals 1 minute, 60 minutes 1 hour, 24 hours is 1 day, 55 days 1 year. That's 5.9 trillion miles, right? That's called the speed of light. The distance that light travels in 1 year is a light year, which is 5.9 trillion miles, right? Now multiply that number by 100,000. That's how big this universe is. That's the Milky Way. Oh, Michael, sorry. So the Milky Way galaxy is. That's number one point. That's one galaxy, and there are 50 billion of them. There are a billion stars in our Milky Way galaxy. Multiply that times 50 billion known galaxies, right?
It'll take your whole life just to write the number.
right. So wait. So you have 50 billion galaxies, the same as the Milky Way galaxy, which is 100,000 light years long. You have the Andromeda galaxy, which is our nearest neighbor, which is 2 million light years away and closing fast. Closing fast means that Andromeda, which is 2.2 million light years away, will catch us traveling at 300,000 miles per hour. Andromeda is coming towards us, right, at 300,000 miles per hour, and it will hit us in 5 billion years. If you better start packing. You want to leave, start packing.
But that balance of the universe doesn't seem to me. When you said balance of atoms and all that, the universe
has imbalances, like even the sun going supernova, that's an imbalance.
I don't know if it's an imbalance. All right. That's part of the balance.
Right.
That imbalance is part of the balance. Right, okay, good. Let's go way further. Andromeda. The furthest galaxy that we know about is 4 billion light years away. That's 4 billion times 5.9 trillion miles, right? There are about 100 million billion stars. Our sun is an average star. The lifespan of our sun is 10 billion years. The death of a star, when a star dies, that means when the hydrogen, we're all made of hydrogen. We're all full of hot air. Me too. Well, everything's made of hydrogen and different combinations of hydrogen, which makes different kinds of atoms, right? Hydrogen and helium, and then so on. So once the star, called the sun, expends all of its hydrogen in 10 billion years, it becomes then a neutron star. It collapses because hydrogen explodes. The sun is an explosion. It's a nuclear explosion, right? Explodes. Now, at a certain point, when all the matter is no longer there, it's going to collapse upon itself. It's going to go, right? Collapse upon itself. 1 teaspoon of that neutron star weighs 600 million tons. So don't call me heavy. 600 million tons. 1 teaspoon of a neutron star. The sun expends more energy in 1 second than has been used in the history of the United States. Or alternatively, even though my wife leaves the sun all the time, maybe we'll do that over here. I get very upset about that because of that reason. Or better, 1 second of the sun's total energy, 1 second of the sun's total energy. How much energy does the sun have? A lot. 1 second of sun's energy total equals 13 million times the total energy used in the United States every single year. Right? Okay, now all the matter that we know about in the universe, 100 million billion stars as our sun, equals 1 or 2% of the matter, and 98% is dark matter. We don't know what it is. Just it's there, but it's dark matter. Right? Dark matter. Of course, matter and energy are constants throughout the universe, which is Einstein's famous theory, equals mc squared. Energy equals mass times speed of light squared. You take any mass and you multiply that by c squared, by the speed of light squared, it's going to make that into energy, which is called a bomb. Any matter, if it's hit with enough force, is going to turn into energy. Now, if that's the case, imagine what energy was released at the Big Bang 12 billion years ago, which is still spewing forth outward into the universe. Okay, now, last point. Our solar system is moving in the same way that somebody mentioned before, that the Earth revolves every 24 hours, the Earth on its axis, right? And around the sun every single year. The entire solar system of ours, the Earth and its planets, is moving at 11 million miles per day. 11 million, you ever feel somewhat flighty? 11 million miles per day.
On its way to?
200 million years, it'll come back to the same spot. So 200 million times 11 million equals the perimeter of the Milky Way galaxy. Right?
It's orbiting the Milky Way galaxy?
No.
It's going around, you're saying?
It's moving. We don't know. It's moving around the galaxy.
I think 2005
finishes. I hope so. I don't want to come back next week. Right. Okay, so now, that should all give us some sense as to the universe. That's my point. Now, when I think of all this, which I do on a regular basis, I come to the conclusion, Marabu Maaseh Hashem, how glorious are your works, O God. Imagine what the universe was like. Imagine in your wildest imaginations how all this is really God's creation. as a theist, I come to that conclusion. Ricky came to another conclusion, that it's all a random, meaningless mass, and that's okay too. But as a theist, I come to the conclusion, and I say, Marabu Masech Hashem, how extraordinary this is. Imagine, we think of God with a G, capital G. A pagan God is a small G. But I would say that even our capital G is not capital enough to fully comprehend what God is all about. Because this is what God created, which we can barely comprehend in any which sense. Look at this last point to read over here, which is going to explain this story a little bit better than I just did. Right? This is from 20 copies to bed. This is from this wonderful book called Stephen Hawking's Universe, which goes through the whole history of everything else. And by the way, again, Stephen Hawking's great contribution to this, in 1970, he spoke about and discovered the laws of a black hole, which is what happens when a star condenses upon itself. It's not really a hole, it's just matter very tightly packed. So those laws correspond very well to what we call the ring of truth. The ring of truth means that everything seems to be fitting in perfectly into its place. Now, what this is saying to us over here,
could it be that the Big Bang thing was a black hole itself?
Yeah, nobody knows, sure. Absolutely, it could be, yeah. Yeah. He then, in chapter 6, talks about the energy that creates everything, all that stuff, and how it all works. Very, very interesting with Rutherford. And at the end, back to Einstein, antimatter's here. Here, the story so far. It is, of course, annoying that everything is not sorted out completely, leaving us with a comforting, neat, totally proven picture of the dynamics of the universe. It's annoying that we don't know it all. But at least our present understanding of matter fits amazingly well with our present understanding of the way the universe has developed. All the mathematical equations can be fitted together to build an astonishing, precise picture of its evolution. It begins with a dramatic Big Bang explosion producing nothing but searing hot energy at first. This energy somehow develops slight variations in its texture. That's whose great notion, Alan Guth, MIT, that it had to work out that way. Otherwise, it would not be worked out. And as it spreads outward, it starts to cool. So it allows for slightly hotter spots within, where within the first second after the Big Bang, energy starts converting into particles and antiparticles and slightly cooler spots, which are destined to become the first voids in space. Most of the particles and antiparticles start to be drawn closer together by the force of gravity, for what is known as the electromagnetic force to make them combine. And most of the antimatter is lost in its annihilations, leaving only mass swirling in growing irregular clumps. Right? Look at the diagram that it shows you over here. Right? The diagram is energy inside of particles for a second, 3 minutes, protons and neutrons, 300,000 years, clouds of hydrogen and helium atoms, stars and proto-galaxies after 1 billion years, and 15 billion years where we are today. Right? That's all down the bottom. Right? His point over here is no diagram can do justice to the evolution of the universe. It grew from no size at all to a size far greater than our magic can grasp in minutes. So in a second, it has undergone more fundamental changes than it has over the last 10 billion years or so. Right? Back to our text. Until 3 minutes after the Big Bang, it is still too hot for these subatomic particles to build anything together. And then some of them start to bind together, will become nuclei of atoms. It takes 300,000 years for things to cool down, enough for electrons to couple with these nuclei first atoms. Then about 20% are heavy gas helium, 80% are hydrogen. All the other known chemical elements will evolve much later. It takes 1 billion years, according to all the equations, for millions and millions and millions of these hydrogen atoms to come together by gravity. There are millions of these clumps, each one destined to become some huge cosmic body, a galaxy. As gravity presses some of the atoms together more and more tightly, the hydrogen begins to fuse in the way that Fred Hoyle in 253, and it's constituted. Stars begin to form, then the emerging galaxy, and eventually they shine. And the whole life cycle begins, in which all the heavier chemical elements are formed. First, hydrogen's atoms fuse to produce helium. Then as the hydrogen starts to get used up, gravitational pressure increases, helium starts to fuse. Only then the heavier elements are produced. Each in turn fusion reaction to produce next chemical element as gravity compresses into star into a denser and denser mass. Once iron has been formed in the star, it either dies slowly and sheds itself into space, leaving a white dwarf star, which cools the brown star, etc., or the star dries dramatically, exploding into a supernova, creating all the elements heavier than iron in the process. The elements drift to a state, so they are drawn by gravity to a new heavenly body. Enough matter is pulled in, a new star can be born. But if new fusion reactions do not get started, what happens then? A planet like Earth can result. In the right conditions, life can evolve on such a planet. Which is exactly how we came to be here, observing the marvel at all for ourselves, after 15 billion years the universe has evolved to be the way we see it today. There are still many people who refuse to believe such an unlikely sounding story. What's more likely, religion or science right now? Science sounds pretty absurd to me. But when we piece together all the evidence from the physics of the very large, the physics of the very small, the macro and the micro, it's hard to construct a better alternative. It's certainly difficult to imagine a more awesome, beautiful, or fitting explanation of the immensity and complexity of everything we see around us. Cosmology has come a long way from the imaginative specification of mathematics and the earliest observations of the naked eye. Right? And the last part we read on your own, from Galileo to Hubble's astonishing evidence, all that. Most cosmologists believe that 90% of the essential nature of the universe is still to be revealed. It is as if we had only so far at the tip of the iceberg in terms of understanding the universe. And again, he goes on to the rest of the universe, discussing the rest of it. So with all of that, you have a good sense now, hopefully, of what the universe is all about. So the next step is, what questions are raised in Bereshit? Right? Now, we look at our Tanakh, or our Chumash. We got to it. Thank you. And we open up to the very first page, and we have Bereshit bara elohim t'shamayim v'ta'aretz. In the beginning of God's creation of the heavens and the earth. And note over here, the poor translation is that which says, in the beginning God created, which fixed at a certain point in time that moment of Big Bang or creation. As opposed to that, the JPS translation, when God began to create heaven and earth. What does that mean differently? That it's still an ongoing process. Creation is not something which took place at one moment in time, but rather it's ongoing. And what verse or what statement in our tefillah says exactly the same thing? You say it every day? If you pray? Hamehadesh b'chol yom tu ma'aseh bereshit. Every day creation is going on. The universe is still expanding. It's still planets, galaxies, stars, and life, question mark, may still be developing. The universe is evolving. We are evolving. And the question is, what are we evolving into? We may be evolving into something that's pure intellect, or pure spirit, as opposed to thinking that we are the end result of creation at this point in time. We may be part of God's evolving universe as human beings. So Bereshit tells us, critically important, that Elohim, and the word Elohim means force or power. The word Elohim means force or power. It's only present in the first chapter. There's no Yud Kei Vav Kei in the first chapter. Yud Kei Vav Kei is that personal name of God which connects to human beings. Elohim is that impersonal force of nature which brought about this whole seven quote-unquote days. So now, when we look at this whole first chapter, and you can look at that on your own and you not read it all to you, I want you to be aware of 2 points. The first point is that God creates light, or light is burst in a Big Bang, and it's an absolute. An absolute is necessary to create. If you don't have an absolute and everything is relative, you have no fixed point from which you can ultimately create. So you need an absolute. Light is a form of energy which is viewed to this day as an absolute. Light always travels at the speed of 100,000 miles per second. Right? That's point number one. Interestingly enough. Then we have something called Tohu Vavohu over here. What is Tohu Vavohu? It's a confusion or a mixture of all matter. Until the process unfolded properly. The third point that one wants to be aware is that, does all this take 7 days? Well, most evidently, you're going to look at this chapter and you're going to say, 1 second. On a most elementary level, the sun takes place on the 4th day. So prior to the 4th day, obviously there were no 24-hour days. That's without any apologetics or interpretations. That's obvious. That point clear?
Well, not totally. The Earth could rotate on an axis without the sun being there.
There was no land yet, even.
At what point?
It's not dependent on the sun.
If you take rotation as being 24 hours, but still the question would be, what's your measurement of time?
But it says by eight o'clock.
So we don't know what that means either.
Day one.
Right. So I'm not wedded to that idea either. But that's on a most elementary level. So now, what questions do we really have emerging from, again, read it for homework, the first 7 days of creation? One, is there a creation? As opposed to the eternal universe, which Aristotle believed in, and for thousands of years, up to Hubble, even then, up to Wilson and Penzias, ever believed in an eternal universe. All of a sudden, now with what Hubble had seen and proven, an expanding universe, and Wilson and Penzias had came to a conclusion of a Big Bang, where therefore everything came together at one point, right? So now we know there's a creation. That's the one question. Eternal universe or creation? Second question, how long did it take? 5,764 years? Is that what we were talking about? Or 12 billion? That's the second question, right? Those are the questions that are raised. Third question is the evolution of mankind. Are we descended from apes? Or you? Or are we something spiritual and distinct, not evolved from apes? That's the question you want to raise, right? Mm-hmm. Now, for some people, there are absolutely no questions whatsoever. From both sides of the spectrum, there are those, let's say, scientists who say, there are no questions, it's obvious, 12 billion, it's obvious human beings evolved from an ape, because we share 99% of the same genetic matter, so obviously we do, and therefore it's obvious, no questions. Those on the other side of the spectrum say, no questions, obviously maybe the scientists came from the ape, but I certainly did not, the religious would say, right? That I came from, spiritually God created me by what it says, right? God gathered the clumps of earth from clay, right? Look at chapter 2, what does it say? Look at chapter 2 for a second. Chapter 2, what happens over here? Vayitzer, verse 7, God fashioned from the ground, from the dust, and human beings, and he blew into his nostrils the breath of life, and man now is a living creature. Right? So, the other side of the spectrum says, there are no questions, the universe is 5,764 years old, and man is distinctly, uniquely creation of God, and no questions. And there are those people who are in between. Those perplexed, who need a guide, who say, I can't deny the legitimacy of science, I cannot deny the legitimacy of the Bible, somehow we have to make this all work together. There has to be some kind of integration of these two disciplines. In the Jewish world, sure, you're going to find people on the entire spectrum. Those who deny, those who accept, and those who integrate. Right? Now, we want to close with one last point. If I find my last point. You take it, Jackie? No. Here it is. Here's something interesting that just came out. Now, I did copy it for you, but I won't give it out to you. This came last week, October 25th, 2003. Science and Space. Study suggests life sprang from clay. Science backed up religion this week in a study that suggests life may have indeed sprung from clay, just as many faiths teach. A team at the Howard Hughes Medical Center Mass General, at the Harvard Teach Hospital in Boston, said that they had shown materials in clay which were key to some of the initial process in forming life. Specifically, clay mixture called, whatever, not only helps from little bags of fat and liquid, but helps cells use genetic material called RNA. That, in turn, is one of the key processes of life. It goes on and on to tell you how life could have come from clay or dirt of the ground. The formation, growth, and division of the earliest cells may have occurred in response to similar interactions with mineral particles and inputs of material and energy. Wrote in a journal called Science. Science is one of the most prestigious journals in the field. We are not claiming that this is how life started. We are saying that we have demonstrated growth and division without any biochemical machinery. Ultimately, if we can demonstrate more natural ways this might have happened, may begin to give us clues to how life could have begun in primitive Earth. Among religious texts that refer to life being formed from the soil is the Bible's book of Genesis, as we just read.
You don't want to explain birth by scientific means. Something.
I'm not saying one way or the other. You could read it one way as you like. You may say this confirms or denies. I'm not coming to any conclusion about it. I'm just bringing it to your attention. Right? So now, one second. So what I'm saying over here is that I am in that middle range or that middle of the spectrum. I'm neither going to deny science nor am I going to deny the legitimacy of the Bible itself. And what I want to do next week is to present five different schools of thought, ranging from the rejectionists all the way to those who accept blindly and all those in between. And then try to come to some solution, some kind of interaction, some kind of integration between science and religion. Questions?
Steven Weinberg, who's mentioned in some of these papers.
Yeah, he's here someplace.
He's a Nobel Prize winner.
Yes.
Avowed atheist. He was bar mitzvah by a local rabbi, David B. Hollander, in Mount Eden Center.
That Bronx. Explains a lot about him. Yeah. You know Rabbi Hollander. I know why he's an atheist. I know about him. That's a nice point. I know about him. That's a nice, interesting point. I'm sorry? Yeah.
He lives in Brighton. He lives in Brighton now.
Does he? Right.
Yeah.
Okay. He's an older man. I mean, he's a pretty old man, Robert Hollander now.
What's that?
Robert Hollander's an older man. He's in his 80s,
he's mid-80s.
Maybe even more, yeah.
But he's quite a
character. I know. Any other questions? Do you want to proceed from here? Or at your own risk, of course. I mean,
we're already
100 billion years.
Come back. Okay, thank you for coming.
Thank you everything for 10 seconds. First, I'd like to thank our lawyers for coming. And I'd like to try it back next week. Also, two announcements. I want to call your attention to the rest of our schedule, in particular, two other classes we have at night. Tomorrow night, by Dr. Henry Hansen, gives a great class on halakha, contemporary issues in halakha.